There's a terrible idea for a podcast.
Each person comes with pre-planned content that they're not going to tell the other person about.
No, that is, I think, fine, actually.
Welcome to another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. From San Diego, California, you're the co-host, Keith Foster.
What's up, Foster kids and Swiss family Robinsons? And with me, as always, is the brainchild of whatever the fuck we're doing, Cassidy Robinson from Los Angeles, California.
Mm-hmm. That's getting more complex every week, I think.
Yeah, that's my thing. Just start talking.
Are you feeling better than you were last week?
Yeah. I was feeling real shitty. And this was actually, I think, probably the worst cold I've had since I've moved to SoCal. Normally it lasts like a day or two, and this lasted like almost a week, it seems like. But I'm feeling bets. That is short for better.
That is not a thing anybody says. Now, I do think that last week was actually one of our better episodes. When I was editing it, I was like, I would be really okay if this was the first episode somebody heard.
I don't like listening to myself.
Mm-hmm. I'm totally used to it by now, but I think maybe you should be sick more often. Maybe that was what was doing us well.
You know what? I'm willing to sacrifice the podcast for my health.
That's not commitment, Keith. We have no movie news today. Oh, I should say, today we're going to be reviewing Annihilation for the main review, and at the end of the show, we're finally going to get to Rod's request for the Discovery. But not yet. Well, not yet.
That's right. You promised me a game. Finally, no fucking movie news. Nothing has happened in Hollywood.
We're getting a game because we have no movie news. And this is something I kind of been wanting to do for a little while. I'll preface the game by saying this. What happened, and don't get too carried away and start saying things because I might ruin the game. But whatever happened to tonally inappropriate power ballads in action movies?
Oh, yes. I already love this. I fucking love this.
There was a period through like the mid-80s to the end of the 90s, a little bit into the 2000s, but not much, where to try and hit the four quadrants, you got to get that girlfriend, you got to get the female audience, they would throw in a really cheesy power ballad with the movie tie-in video and put it into the soundtrack.
Well, whatever happened to like just original soundtracks? I mean Black Panther just had one with Kendrick Lamar.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but that's been like the first time something like that has happened in a long time.
Yeah, movie soundtracks is not the thing it used to be. In the 90s, there was like that was a peak of movie soundtracks.
Song never even
had to appear in the movie. It was like music inspired by the tone of the movie.
Have you listened to Kendrick Lamar's Black Panther album? There's like two songs that are actually in the movie, and then the rest is just a hip hop album. And it's like full on parental advisory too.
Well, shit. I wonder if there's an edited version you can buy for the kids.
I don't know.
I'm going to quiz you, Keith. I have 8 songs here from power ballads from these action movies in the 80s and 90s and a little bit into the 2000s. And you are going to name, I'm going to play the clip, and then you're going to name or try to name the name of the artist, the name of the song, and what movie it was for.
I love it.
There is 24 possible points.
Wait, so name of the artist, name of the song, and name of the movie? Fuck, I have to get all three?
Well, you get more points if you do.
Okay.
But we'll tally up your points at the end.
Oh, Jesus. So, I'm so bad at this already. I know it.
Oh, well, some of these are pretty easy.
Okay.
But this requires technology, so I'm going to try and make that happen right now.
And everything else you'll fix in editing.
Hopefully. Here we go. This is the first clip. And don't say anything until the clip is done.
Okay. Ready. And thank God we're together. And I just want to stay with you in this moment forever. Forever and ever. I don't want to close my eyes. Okay, Keith. All right, start me with a softball.
Yep.
Start me with literally the song that I almost mentioned to reference what you're talking about.
Exactly.
That is I Don't Want to Miss a Thing by Aerosmith from the movie Armageddon.
Ding, ding, ding. You got that one, Keith.
I know. Like I said, you're starting off easy.
Starting you off easy, we're gonna move back in the timeline quite a bit for number two here, but let's go.
All right.
Okay, Keith, do you know that one?
Okay, this is good. Right now, I hope listeners are screaming into their devices. Fuck. Okay. So the song is Take My Breath Away, right?
Mm-hmm.
Artist. Fuck.
Artist is a little bit more difficult. They're kind of a one-hit wonder, but they did have a couple other hits.
Artist. Okay, so this one's going back a little bit before my time. This is an 80s one, right? Mm-hmm. So this one I'm not so sure. Artist, I don't know.
What about the movie?
Fuck. I feel like this has been used in a lot of movies.
It's one very prominent.
But yeah. And
I'll say this. This was not the only big song to come from this movie, but the other one was more of a rock song.
Dirty Dancing?
These are all action movies. I'll give you one more guess.
Oh, fuck. What? Oh, no. Have I seen it?
Guaranteed, yes.
True Romance.
No, that would have been in the early 90s. But it is a Tony Scott film, so maybe that was what got you fuzzed in your brain. It's Top Gun, The Love Theme by Brazil.
Yeah, I never would have guessed the artist.
Take My Breath Away.
Fuck! Okay.
Yeah, the next one's a little harder, too.
God damn it.
So let's hope you got this. But here's our third track.
Okay, ready. Well, at least they gave me something. I didn't have to steal or have to win. Well, they tell me that I'm wanted. Yeah, I'm a wanted man. I'm a goat in your stable. I'm a cane. What's the aim of Mr. Catch Me If You Can? I'm going down. I have no idea. I'm pretty sure it's Bon Jovi.
Correct.
But as for movie and song, I have no fucking clue.
Okay, well, I don't know if this will help you, but I would consider this song a spiritual successor to Bon Jovi's Dead or Alive.
That's what I thought. That's the song I thought of. It kind of sounds like Wanted Dead or Alive.
Yeah, so the producers of this movie definitely went to Bon Jovi and said, give us another Dead or Alive.
Okay. I'm just going to take a shot in the dark.
Okay.
The movie is John Carpenter's Vampires. And the song is No Sleep Till Dawn.
No. definitely not. It is Blaze of Glory.
Ah!
And it was featured in the Young Guns 2 soundtrack.
Fuck, of course it was Young Guns 2. Oh, no, now that you say that, that is obviously the only answer. God damn it.
Oh, I'm glad this is working. Okay. The next one's
we're like a morning radio show right now.
Yeah, we've went full on zoo radio. Okay, the next one's an easy one, so strap in. All right.
Because everything I do, I do it for you.
Yes.
Okay, I'm going to get fucked on the artist for this one.
This is the go-to guy for this genre. He appears on this very list more than once. But this is his first appearance.
I don't know. I know the voice, but I cannot conjure his name out of the ether. But
Canadian? Does that help?
No, not at all. All I can think of now are Kids in the Hall members. Dave Foley. So Dave Foley, and I believe this was for the Prince of Thieves soundtrack.
Yes, it was. Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves.
Okay.
It was also my brother's wedding song.
I knew that as well.
And it's by Bryan Adams.
Ah!
Not to be confused with Ryan Adams. Okay. So, this one's a little tricky, I think.
God damn it. A lot of these have been tricky.
All right. You remember that one?
You're tricky because you're cutting these off like right before the hook.
Right. Right, but they literally say the name of the song.
I believe that was How Do I Live Without You?
Very good, yes.
By Faith Hill?
No.
Fuck. I don't know.
One of the other ones. What movie, though?
Okay, this
is maybe, in my opinion, of this whole list, the most tonally inappropriate.
Have I seen this movie?
Yes, you have.
What?
I'll give you a year. This is roughly 97, 98.
I've seen it?
Oh, for sure, yeah.
I was going to say City of Angels.
All action movies.
But... Okay, all action movies. Okay, so in that case, since I've got it stuck in my head, I'm going to say The Crow 2, City of Angels.
No. No, that was like a kind of goth metal soundtrack.
Yeah, I know.
Sort of underrated, actually. The first one was better. It was. The movie was Con Air.
Fucking my ass. I knew that. God
and
damn it.
And this version... was recorded by Trisha Yearwood, but another country artist recorded the same song the same year and both charted. I'll give you a point if you can name that other artist.
Bonnie Raitt.
What? No. Leanne Rimes. Leanne Rimes.
Fuck, I thought for sure I had it with Faith Hill. God damn it. This is a good game because I'm getting legitimately upset.
I just hope that the listeners are playing along. Okay, so here we go. This is, I'll say this about this one. The next one I'm going to play is the most recently released song on the whole list.
Okay, so this one was probably in the 2000s.
All right, here we go.
All right. Someone told me love would all save us. But how can that be? Look what love gave us. Hero, save me, not good. Of course I know this one. Okay, I don't know if I know the exact name. It's Hero, or My Hero, or something mm-hmm. like that.
Yes.
Okay, this is a little tricky.
A little.
Because I don't think it was Nickelback. I think it was a Chad Kroeger solo experience.
I'm going to give you the point for that, and I will give you an extra point if you can name the person he's singing with and or the band that person also sang for.
This was a duet? Oh, fuck. Oh, god damn.
Because I literally had to look it up, because I was just like, oh, it's the guy from Blah, but I couldn't remember his name.
I'm going to say Carlos Santana.
No.
No, I don't know.
Carlos Santana only plays guitar.
I know. Yeah, I don't know who he did it to.
Josie Scott of the band Seether.
Really?
Yes.
Huh.
And what movie is that from, Keith?
This is Obbs from Spider-Man.
Yes, it is.
The first Spider-Man with Tobey Maguire's.
Yes. All right. this one is probably the most difficult, but I'll play it.
Oh, goddamn. You live, I'll make a stand on. I'll be the rock you can lean on. Love inside. I swear I'll always be strong. Then there's a reason why. I'll prove to you we belong. I'll be the wall that protects you from the wind and the rain, from the hurt and the pain.
All right.
You should have let me have the chorus for that one.
I almost did, but again, there's only three categories: artist, movie, and song. But since there are three individual artists who are collaborating in this song, I will give you possible 3 points just for if you can get all three artists.
Okay. Well, that's tricky. Because I thought I heard me some Michael Bolton in there.
You did not.
Okay. You mentioned he came up a couple times on this list, and I think I heard him, Bryan Adams?
Yes. He is one of the three. So I'll give you at least 1 point per artist.
I have no idea the song. I'm gonna guess, My Rock, and I'm gonna guess it was for the movie The Rock.
No. it was. You want to hear the other two, or do you want to try and take a stab at artists again?
Nah, just give it to me.
All right. It's a collaboration between Sting, Bryan Adams, and Rod Stewart.
Fuck. That's who I heard, not Michael Bolton's sweet, sweet pipes.
the name of the song is All for One, brackets, and One for Love for the Three Musketeers soundtrack.
Fuck. Of course. There's three of them. That's so good.
I even hinted at it a couple times.
Ah, you did. Fucking Jesus.
All right. But we're going to sandwich this with the last track here. This is, I think, another easy one.
Yeah, these have all been fucking hard. Yes! My power, my pleasure, my pain, baby. To me, you're like a grown addiction that I can't deny. Won't you tell me it's unhealthy, baby? But did you know that when it snows, my eyes become large and the light that you shine can't be seen? To
got
me.
That one?
I can't sing this. This is my man Seal with Kiss from a Rose from, drumroll please, Batman Forever.
Yes, it is.
See, the superhero ones I got.
Yeah, originally when I thought of this and then I thought of the Spider-Man one, I was like, maybe I could do this all superhero, and then I was like, no, I definitely can't.
You know, I think if Marvel's lacking anything, it's badass power ballads.
Yeah, maybe there's not enough power balladeers in our modern age, but these Marvel movies, they need to step it up with the four quadrants and get us some cheesy-ass, tonally inappropriate power ballads.
Hey, the Kendrick Lamar album is pretty fucking cool, and that was like the song they used during the end credits. It actually kind of gave me like a flashback to that time. So keep that a coming, Marvel. And DC too. Why not?
You got 16 out of 24 points, Keith.
You know, that's better than I thought I'd do.
Yeah, yeah, I would say so.
I'm really bad with artists. That's the one that fucks me.
Yeah, and a lot of these guys we haven't heard from in a while.
Yeah. And during that time, like, I didn't really pay attention to who I think I could have killed it if I had been this age at that time.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't really care who the artists were then.
Yeah. Well, I was all about that VH1 top 10 of the week. So I definitely put this list together without looking at the internet very much.
Nice. Can we just, like, instead of doing a rest of the episode, can we just listen to Kiss from a Rose on repeat?
Like, all the way. Maybe I'll fade us out with Kiss from a Rose for the download. Okay, so let's get into the movies, because we do have movies to talk about.
Yeah.
That's enough ridiculousness.
No, that was fun. I liked that.
Keith, describe to me, if you can, what happens in the new film, Annihilation.
Oh, shit. You just went into it. Mm-hmm. So Annihilation. So there's this strange, let's start with Natalie Portman.
Okay.
Natalie Portman is this research biologist. Her husband has been away on military leave, or on a military mission, sorry, to be specific. He's been gone for a year. She's given up on him. And then all of a sudden, he just randomly shows up on a fucking Saturday afternoon like everything's cool.
Mm-hmm.
She freaks out. He freaks out. He's very sick. The government gets involved. They tell her that he went into this weird rainbow booger area of the Earth.
Mm-hmm. That they're keeping a secret.
Yeah, so it's this quarantine area called the Southern Reach. So she decides that she's going to join the next team that's going to explore this area to see if she can find a cure for what's making her husband sick. Mm-hmm. She goes into the rainbow blob, and then hijinks ensue.
You could say that.
They go into this area and it's like it's different, and it's hard for them to sort of figure out how it's different at first, and mm-hmm. as they go deeper and deeper into the reach, things get weirder and weirder.
Yes. And I think it's important to mention that throughout the time that the government's been watching this weird phenomena that landed on this beach. They've sent in multiple teams, and her husband has so far been the only person to come back.
Yes. Yeah, that is pretty important, actually. So I told you I started listening to the audiobook for this. Mm-hmm. And I'm not that far in. I'm only like a little bit in, and it starts very differently. Mm-hmm. So I'm one of those people who I like to see the movie first and then read the book, because if I read the book first, then all I think about are the differences.
Exactly. And in fact, when you said that you were going to read the book, I was like, oh, I mean, I thought that's cool. We'll have that to talk about. But I was like, I wouldn't want to do that, because I feel like this movie is, I could already tell just by the trailers that it's very beholden to its reveals, and it's going to be sort of a strange sort of unfolding. And I kind of want that experience.
Well, yeah. And that was kind of what I got from it as well. And that's sort of why I stopped. But yeah, I don't know if I even need to say it. Actually, from what I have read of the book so far, it starts very differently than this movie does.
Right. I think there's a few things worth mentioning before we get into the actual content of the movie. One of the big things is this is featuring an all-female cast, or a largely female cast. You have Oscar Isaac in here playing Natalie Portman's estranged husband, Kane. Mm-hmm. There's a few male characters at the beginning of the movie, a professor who works with Natalie Portman at the college that she works at. But the rest of the cast, specifically this team that she enters into what they call the Shimmer, this sort of glowing, amorphous rainbow orb that covers this one part of a beach. The rest of the team that she goes in with is all female.
It's also a pretty small cast too, because like,
yes, very intimate sort of cast.
There's and also some rando scientists at the end.
Yeah,
like I think Benedict Wong is in it.
Yeah, he's the guy who's interviewing Natalie Portman throughout the movie, sort of this framing device. But we have Jennifer Jason Leigh, who plays sort of the leader of the group, the one who's sort of the one of the lead scientists who's trying to figure out what's going on. She sort of decides she's going to lead the team this time instead of stay out in the sidelines. She feels very responsible for all the people who's gone missing.
Well, specifically, she is a psychologist who psychologically profiles all of the people who have gone into this area.
Right. Works for the government. Gina Rodriguez and my girl Tessa Thompson.
Yeah.
From Creed and Dear White People. And Thor Ragnarok. Tuva Novotny, who I'm not as familiar with, but she's in there too. You know, there's been a lot of hubbub about this whole female cast thing, and it's a part of the story. I wouldn't even say that it's cool that there's a big sci-fi action film or sci-fi horror, whatever you want to call it, that it has a female cast, but I would say that's pretty incidental to the story. It's not a particularly feminist film. It's not really about them being female, but it, you know.
Okay, I might get a little obnoxious because that from what I have read of the book, that mm-hmm. was kind of a sticking point, was like this was the first all-female team they sent in.
The way it's written in the movie, in the screenplay, is that it's from up to that point it had all been military and mostly men, and so they thought maybe whatever it is, because the two big theories about why they don't come back is either something in there is killing them or they're killing each other. And so they want to try something new with this female exposition.
Yes.
The other big thing I wanted to mention is this is written and directed by Alex Garland. Alex Garland previously was a novelist who had written The Beach, which then Danny Boyle adapted into a screenplay and directed. And then he began to work with Danny Boyle exclusively as his screenplay writer for Sunshine and 28 Days Later before he went off on his own and directed his first film, Ex Machina, which I loved a lot.
He also wrote Dread. Worth noting.
Yes, he did. He did do Dread as well. So he's a big genre guy. You know, zombie movies, outer space,
sci-fi,
robots. You know, this is his bread and butter. And I was excited to see what Alex Garland would do with a directorial sophomore effort.
So the first little bit of it, I definitely am glad I stopped reading the book where I did, because there were a lot of little differences that I kept getting hung up on. Like one of the things specifically is that they only go into the Shimmer with one assault rifle, and the rest are like pistols that they have. Like in a lockbox, but they all have knives. So they're like very specifically not armed in the book. So I did think that was like one interesting choice in the movie that's like very different. Mm-hmm. So like the first little bit, I had to sort of shut that part of my brain off. And I was just like, okay, I'm very glad I didn't finish the book. Because that's all I would have been doing the whole time. So the movie. All right. This movie is pretty cold and clinical.
Okay.
In its approach to character and emotion. It's very observational.
It's a little detached.
Yeah, but I think that's intentional. This is also one of the prettiest horror sci-fis I've ever seen, and one of the most horrific. This movie kind of fucked me up.
It's creepy as hell.
And not even, but here's the thing, like, I remember I saw the trailer. It sort of markets it as a monster movie, and it's not really that. Like, it's got some monsters, but it's more of a philosophical fuck you up.
Yeah, what? I would say that's one of the ways.
I mean, the monsters are horrific as fuck.
Yeah.
But that there's no sort of focus or fetishization of the monsters. They're just sort of there. Like that's not the point. This isn't Natalie Portman versus Predator, which I think some of the marketing could maybe lead you to believe. No, I think what they discover in the Southern Reach is way more horrifying, because it gets to those very questions of like, who are we and what are we doing in the universe, and what,
you know, even what is our place in the
fucking matters,
the grander scheme of things. Yeah, I would say this is one of the. Of all of the, you know, like, movies that's approached sort of Lovecraftian-style horror, I would say this has probably gotten the closest. And there's no, like, giant squid monsters, and there's no, like, the typical kind of Lovecraft stuff.
I actually think that's interesting you bring up Lovecraft. I didn't think about that, but now that you mention it, it's sort of right on the money.
I mean, that's really what it is, because it's like, you can understand, like, at certain points of the film, like, how it's not necessarily about being afraid for your life in a visceral sort of sense. It's about being so blown away by the grandiosity of the inexplainable that it just drives you to madness.
Well, it's like I always told you, I would be terrified to be in the ocean with a whale.
Yes.
Because whales are so big, I can't even fathom like a creature existing that's big. And just to see that and like touch it and be in the water with it would be completely overwhelming to me.
Right.
This is like that times a thousand. It's not like, it's not because of the size of the creatures or whatever. It's because of the size of the concepts we're dealing with.
Yeah. And how surreal it gets at certain points.
Yeah. So Lovecraft, I think, is a good reference point. I kind of thought in my mind, I was like, but to me, this is like if the movie Contact was a horror movie.
that it has those kind of elements to it. I was noticing. Okay, considering that, like, there's been all of these sequels and prequels and collaboration films or whatever for Alien, I think this has felt the most like the first Ridley Scott Alien since that movie. In tone, and the fact that we have this small crew kind of going into this thing and discovering, you know, this weird thing. There's some body horror elements in here that are kind of similar. Structurally,
I have to argue with you a little bit on this.
It's not as much of a like straightforward monster movie as in the same way. It doesn't have that kind of like, well, you know, I was gonna say it doesn't have that sort of picking off each crew member one at a time thing, but it does actually.
It's so tonally different.
I think it's aesthetically different, and I think that's different than tonally different.
No, I think it's pretty tonally different. I think this is a much more bleak movie than Alien.
Yeah, maybe if you get down to it. I mean, you don't have Jonesy the cat. But
Alien is.
But like, for instance, there's that scene at the beginning of Alien when they first find the giant spaceship, you know, the alien spacecraft, and you know, there's all this sense and wonder because there wasn't a Prometheus to ruin it. And there's that moment where you're like, whoa, what the fuck, and you see that, you know, Giger design for the first time and that kind of stuff. That was how I felt at certain parts of this movie. It was like the first time experiencing that.
I would agree with you if this whole movie was like the intro to Alien, where you're just like, what the fuck is actually going on?
Sure. I mean, there's definitely, I was feeling shades of The Thing. I was also feeling shades of, towards the end, especially of the Doug Trumbull stuff from 2001 Space Odyssey. So I think this movie is definitely pulling from a lot of different places for inspiration. But I think the way that it synthesizes this all together, pun not intended, is really unique and really hellish, actually. Like, the way I would describe the movie is like, it's like dying and thinking you went to heaven and slowly realizing you went to hell.
That's a pretty good summation of it. Yeah, I'm going to go out on a limb and say that you probably, if you're listening to this, you have probably never seen a movie like this. It's sort of insane. Like,
yes.
It's Alien by way of Darren Aronofsky. Because it gets so, like, dreamlike and strange at moments. And it does kind of jump around in time. Like, it feels like you're in a nightmare that you don't know is a nightmare at first. And the thing that I like about it, the thing that I think it did really well, is there's horrific events, but there's no specific inciting horror event. It just sort of gets worse and worse, and there's just this sort of feeling of dread and foreboding through the whole movie that you're just like, I don't know what's coming next, but I know I don't fucking like it.
Yes, it's this weird juxtaposition too, because the production design,
it's all one of the prettiest movies you'll see.
Yeah, I mean, there's stuff in here that looks like right out of like Princess Mononoke or something. Like, it's so like pastel and pretty and rainbowy, but at the same time, it's all wrong.
Yeah, and like the scary, it almost bucks every horror movie convention, because like the stuff, it doesn't linger on the monsters. And truly horrific stuff happens during the day, during like the brightest times.
Yeah, that's true. I would say there's a few good monster sequences in there.
There are. Like, if you're going to it for monsters, you won't be disappointed, because it honestly has one of the scariest, most creative monsters I've ever seen.
Agreed. I would say, like, if the Bravo were to update their, like, top 100 horrific moments, this has one of those scenes.
Yeah, we're talking about the same
thing,
right?
Maybe a couple.
There, I was going, oh, that is so fucked up.
Yeah. I mean, there's a couple white knuckles in here.
And poor Ashley, she's not super into horror movies. And I thought it would be kind of more of sci-fi, but it's,
I did too.
And that's the thing. It doesn't feel like a horror movie. That's one of the things I really liked about it. It just feels, like you said, wrong. But yes. I loved it for its wrongness. It does its wrongness so right.
Yes, it is. I would say, after having seen it, this is 100% a horror film. And I, you know, I contribute every once in a while to the horror subreddit. And I know that this movie, unfortunately, is not doing very well. It kind of flopped this past weekend. And so I wanted to, like, tell people, hey, you should definitely go see this. So I did a little post or whatever. And I said, they're not marketing as a horror film, but it is. Go see it. And a few people who had seen it already said, oh, yeah, this is definitely horror. And they're calling it cosmic horror. So it's like a subgenre, I guess. I guess that's kind of like what Lovecraft is.
Yeah, that's very Lovecraftian.
Yeah, and that's, yeah, all I knew is, you know, if the witch is black metal as fuck, this is prog metal as fuck. I wanted to go home and listen to Tool records.
Right? Yeah, but but it also has this, like, sort of southern folksy guitar. It never, that's one of the things I really like about the movie. Yeah, it has this
really sparse, interesting soundtrack.
It's so restrained. It never mm-hmm. is, it doesn't ever feel like it's forcing that sort of tone.
There's not a lot of money shots. There's, you know, the movie is very, it's also very, very restrained with its characters. Maybe too restrained with the characters. I feel like if we're getting into,
from what I've read of the book, it's even more so
than the book.
Yeah. Well, yeah. No. The book is even more. Again, I'm not super far into it, But from what I've read of the book and from the movie, like, I got a lot more sort of understanding of the characters and character backstory than I have from the book yet.
Yeah, we know a little bit about the characters. We know that they all kind of come from these past traumas. And, it's, you know, throughout the movie, those traumas, they're sort of reconciling with throughout this weird, crazy, surreal experience. Mostly we know about Natalie Portman. We learn a little bit more about Jennifer Jason Leigh, I think, than the others. But for the most part, I would say that the characters are kind of like archetypes. Again, very alien-like, that first crew of the Nostromo.
Well, it's. I think that's one of the things that adds to. I actually like how sparse the background from the characters is, because we're definitely seeing it from Natalie Portman's point of view, and I think that adds something to the fact that, like, she doesn't know if she can really trust these people or count on them in situations in when people start to lose their shit, you know, she doesn't really know what people are capable of. And I think that does add something, whereas if we did get more in depth, like, they felt real enough to me that I wasn't like, okay, these are so broad that it's like taking me out of the movie. It just felt like people that I didn't know, if that makes sense.
Yeah. No, yeah. I mean, I think the actors are definitely there for it. The tone, like you said, is pretty detached and it's a little cold. And I don't think that that's a bad thing. Maybe it slips into dour every now and then, but I think that it makes up for it in spades.
Oh, fuck. I just remember the part where they find the memory card.
Oh, yeah. Oh, Jesus. Yeah. I mean, there's some squirmy stuff in this movie.
And that's saying something that when that happens, like, enough other crazy shit happens that I sort of forgot about that. And that's fucking intense.
That was one of those moments I wanted to, like, cover my eyes or look away or wince, but I, like, forced myself to just, like,
me too. I did the same thing.
It's so fucked up that I'm like, I got it. This could be important to the plot, so I have to actually watch what's happening.
Well, it was just like, I have to know. I have to know what the fuck is. To me, this is like all of the promise of a J.J. Abrams mystery with all of the payoff.
Yeah, like if those things, like, actually totally worked.
Yeah, because it starts so mysteriously, and you never get 100% of the answers.
No, and I think that might be something people are annoyed with. I think people who kind of like more traditional, kind of three-act, you know, story arcs are going, might be frustrated that there's an ambiguous ending, that we don't know a lot about what's going on. We don't really learn all that much about what's going on by the end of the movie. It's, but that's not what the movie's about.
No, it's not. It's, I dug it.
I think, you know, I mean, I'll say this, I would be very surprised if this doesn't end up in my top five by the end of the year. If there's five other movies that are better than this by the end of the year, we've done very good in 2018.
I agree. I also think this movie has some of the most gorgeous art design I've ever seen. Like,
yeah, it's like Lisa Frank on a bad acid trip.
Yeah. Kinda.
I had that one saved. I have a bunch of like weird Annihilation jokes that I want to make on Twitter, but nobody's seeing this movie, so they fall flat. My other one was, this is what Jordan Peterson thinks is going to happen if the postmodernists take over the world.
And I mean, it is...
This is my favorite movie based on a Windows 98 screensaver.
Okay, stop.
Okay.
Okay, actually, now that I think about it, that's pretty good. Yeah, some very menacing fractals in this movie.
Yeah,
I mean, this movie's gorgeous to look at, and it will, if it doesn't leave you a little fucked up, then I don't want to know you, because you're scary.
Yeah, I posted that thing, and I've got a lot of responses to it on Reddit, and it's overwhelmingly positive, but there are a few people... And I'll be interested to hear what you have to say about this, who complain about the CGI. I thought it was pretty solid. There are a few moments where I'm like, oh, yeah, I can tell that's CGI. But for the most part, I think the way it's integrated with practical is pretty good. And
I think it also, either because there's this element of surrealness of, I don't even know if this is actually happening or if the main character is having a mental breakdown.
Mm-hmm.
There was really only one scene that really stood out to me, and it's very quick. It's the first time that they're...
attacked?
It's the first time they're attacked at night.
Mm-hmm.
When the monster sort of lurches down, you can see a little too much of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm talking about.
I know what you're talking about. Yeah, there's some moments in wide shots where they're obviously they rely on the CGI a little bit more, specifically with the creatures. But I think they use enough practical and close up that I was able to suspend my disbelief pretty easily.
Yeah, they're pretty few and far between. I don't think... No, to me, that wasn't a criticism of the movie, because I was just so in awe of what I'm seeing.
Mm-hmm.
And trying to figure out what's happening.
My only other like legitimate criticisms of the movie, my criticisms, because I think the CG is fine. My only legitimate criticisms of the movie is, this is another movie about a team of scientists who don't behave like scientists. They already know that there's something going on that's radiation involved, because that's one of the things they talk about with Oscar Isaac being sick, and yet they don't enter with hazmat suits. Their first mission that they're going to try to go all the way through instead of just like maybe a couple feet,
I agree. Also, just like
collect things a little bit at a time.
Since we're getting into the nitty gritty of the criticisms, also like Natalie Portman's a biologist, which means she's an expert on all biology forever. Like, you know, there's a huge difference between a marine biologist and a botanist.
Right.
So
I think they can, I think cell structure and stuff like that, I think there's close enough analogs that even if you're not
sure,
if that's not your specific field, you can go like, oh, that's mitochondria or whatever.
Sure. There are parts when it works and parts where I'm like, okay, like there's a sort of exposition-y moment at the beginning where she looks at a bunch of flowers and she's like, well, that's not possible. And I'm like, I don't know that you'd know that right away.
Yeah, that was the Laura Dern moment when she's looking at the leaf. This shouldn't be here.
Yeah. So there are a couple moments like that. For the most part, it's truncated enough and the story's compelling enough that it doesn't really stick out. But every once in a while, I was like, okay, you're not a scientist or whatever.
Yeah, but that's just a, I had to turn my brain off for that. I was like, okay, they're not behaving like scientists at all. But that's okay, you know.
Yeah, it's not a deal breaker. You could argue that what they're experiencing is like emotional enough, and that what they're going through is like changing them enough, because they do actually even mention their mental states being altered. So sure, we can write that off as, you know, a residual effect or whatever. And also there was a moment at the very end with Benedict Wong where he literally just like comes out and says
the thing.
Yeah, and I'm like, I didn't need that
entire framing device. I mean, I think you might need a little bit just to be like, just to kind of cap it or whatever. But I think for the most part, the cutting back and forth to the framing device, I felt like that was almost felt sort of like a studio suggestion. Like, we need to hold the audience hands a little bit through this because it is so weird.
Yeah, and I actually
need these grounding moments every once in a while. But I actually thought I would have liked to have been deeper into the story by not doing that.
I actually didn't mind it for the most part, because there's some weird visual clues. If you haven't watched it, just all I'll say is watch the tattoos.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah. And that I didn't notice until things started jumping around in time. So I do think that there is some information that's given that it is purposely jarring you as an audience member in ways that you don't realize.
Cool. Okay.
So I didn't mind it till the very end, and then it sort of wraps up in sort of a neat little package and ends on a little bit of a cliffhanger that I didn't need.
I think the cliffhanger is interesting, and
I love, you know, how withholding we have to be on this.
I know.
I don't want to spoil anything for people who want to see this.
I don't either, but we both had different kind of interpretations of the ending, and because of that, I was like, oh, this is kind of an Inception spinning top ending. Like, and anybody who goes is going to be able to have a different read.
Yeah.
And I like that about it,
actually. Yeah, I mean, me and Ashley had sort of different ideas of what might have happened there. So, I didn't hate that. It was specifically the wrapping up with the science stuff that I was like, okay, I didn't necessarily need this. I really liked the way this movie unfolds. It gets weirder and weirder and weirder. At the very beginning, I thought maybe it was a little too withholding. Like when things were in sort of the real world.
We've seen a lot of movies kind of approach story in a similar fashion. So it reminded me a little bit of Arrival in that way. It had this kind of, had this sort of fractured narrative,
while we're comparing it to movies, that I also thought that was like, this is like Arrival if Arrival was a horror movie. Also, right. I liked this more than Arrival.
I enjoyed Arrival,
but I think
this movie is more, maybe, you know, for lack of a better word, maybe just a little schlockier than Arrival. But I think as a story, it pays off more. And I think that it is frankly more interesting to watch.
I agree. I think Arrival was sort of unnecessarily withholding, and I think this movie, it works better. Because it plays with the, what am I seeing? What is even real? It plays with the surreal nature for more than just a twist ending.
Right. Correct.
Also, this deals with, like, the core aspects of horror. Like, just the idea of otherness, it's...
Well, John Carpenter once said in an interview that I watched that there's two kinds of horror. If the wise man or the storyteller, the shaman, is telling a horror story at the campfire, he tells one of two stories. One is horror is out there, horror is the other, and we must be afraid of the other. And the other story is the horror is within us. We are the horror. And that's a harder story to tell. I think this movie kind of gets away with doing both.
Yeah. It, well, and it kind of makes you question, like, okay, which one is it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I agree. Man, and the fucking climax is creepy as fuck.
This and without any, like, traditional creepy... I mean, there's a moment in the movie that's, like... There's a lot of moments in the movie that are, I guess, like, conventionally creepy. But then there's stuff like that... There's scenes in it that creep me out in ways I didn't know I could be creeped out.
Yeah, and that's what I mean when I say it sort of twists a lot of conventions on its head, because this movie really challenges the idea that... There's the idea, like when we see Signs, right? The movie Signs, mm-hmm, with Mel Gibson, whatever.
Right.
And one of the big disappointments of that movie is when you see the alien, because it's such a, this is what a movie studio version of an alien looks like.
Mm-hmm.
And there's that idea of the audience can always imagine something scarier.
Right.
This movie straight up challenges that, and I think proves it wrong, because I couldn't think of this shit. And then when I see it, I'm like, I do not fucking like that.
In a good way.
Yeah, in a good way. In a, I'm going to think about that image for a while.
Yes. Yeah.
This movie sticks to your ribs.
Yeah, I highly recommend it. I don't want to say anything more without laboring the review, but I think I'm giving it an A-minus just for those few quibbles, but I think that it's a really fucking fantastic film, a great horror film, a really interesting sci-fi.
Yeah, it's pretty rare for you to give a movie an A-minus. Yeah, I agree. That's the grade I gave it, an A-minus. There's a couple little thorny spots, mm-hmm, but overall, this is a fucking great way to start the year.
Yep, I'm excited for Alex Garland, the director, because he's turning out to be just as great of a director as he is a writer.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's get into the other sci-fi film we have to talk about, and that is The Discovery. This is a Netflix film that came out last year, and it stars Robert Redford, and Jason Segel is the main character, and Rooney Mara. We also have Jesse Plemons in there as well. But it's about the future where...
An alternate present.
Yes, possibly. We'll say the nearish future, where the life after death has been scientifically proven. They've been able to figure out, Robert Redford specifically, the scientist, who's been able to figure out that we don't know exactly what happens, but we know that consciousness, whatever we know it to be, goes somewhere after death. And the unexpected side effect of this discovery is that it causes mass suicides across the globe. And now everyone's not afraid of death in the same way they used to be. And so if they're not loving life, they just want to, you know, start over like a video game. So, well, fuck this shit. And they, you know, they kill themselves and try to see what's beyond. Even though we don't exactly know what is beyond, but we hopefully know that there's something better. In the middle of all of this, we have Jason Segel, who's sort of the protagonist of the film. He's the son of Redford, and he is skeptical of the discovery. He is very critical of the information that's been put out and the way that it's been put out. And he returns home, sort of prodigal son style, to hash things out with his dad, and finds that his dad is now running a strange compound in the middle of nowhere with all these people who are borderline suicidal, who, you know, are looking for answers. So they're working for him in jumpsuits and doing kind of menial labor around this big estate that he bought by a beach. And along with him is Rooney Mara playing Isla, who is a suicidal woman who's gone through a lot of things herself, and he sort of brings her along for company, and because he sort of feels responsible, maybe. You find out things about all of that. Yeah, what did you think of The Discovery?
Okay. So I'll give you my overall vibe of this movie, and then I'll get into the more specifics later.
Sure.
So I did watch this movie sort of in two parts.
I did too.
Yeah, and which I think is a mistake. I really liked the world and the concepts and the setup.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think the third act shoots itself in the foot trying to be too sci-fi.
Maybe a little bit. Yeah.
I really loved the concept. Just this idea of, like, what would it be like if we decided that, you know, discovered there was life after death. Mm-hmm. I thought that was cool. I liked all the cult stuff. That's where all the engines were firing to me. I was like, ooh, mm-hmm. yeah. Like, yeah. Okay. What is going on here? And then once it becomes a sci-fi movie, that's when I'm like, that's when it lost me. And that was like almost the exact part where I stopped watching and then picked it up later. And I was super into it. And then when I started watching it later, I was like, why am I not into this now?
Oh,
like, I really liked the first two thirds of it. And then I just think it gets kind of up its own ass.
Possibly. Yeah. I would contend that's not, I mean, I don't know, you know, might feel differently about certain things. My overall take is kind of similar. I started it, got about 20 minutes in, and it was so, I don't know, kind of riddled with indie movie cliches from the get-go. And I was feeling a lot of exposition early on, which I get, you know, this is a sci-fi world. We have to sort of build it up. We have to, like, explain this and that and the other to sort of get to the story stuff. And the story stuff does come. But at first, I was like, all right, this feels a little... and then when I got back into the movie, I actually got into it more towards that middle act, like you're saying, when they first show up to the compound, and there's all this weird stuff going on there, and they're, like, you know, kidnapping dead bodies and whatever.
Yeah, yeah, that I was like, oh, okay, this is... That's when I... And, you know, it's probably my own fault for, like... I don't know. I've been listening to a lot of podcasts and true crime stuff about cults lately.
Sure.
And just like the concept of cults and the cult mind is pretty
very interesting. This movie is definitely not about that, though.
But that's the stuff I was way more into. Was just like, excuse me.
They maybe could have mined that a little better.
So much of the focus of this movie is not on actually what comes after death. The focus of the movie is how are people going to react to that.
Exactly.
And that's what I thought was really interesting. And then the whole third act sort of abandons that idea completely to answer the question of what comes after. And I'm like, I don't care. We don't, like, you're not going to answer this with your movie. We don't know. Like, sure, this, and that's when it starts to feel like sort of a creative writing project where I'm like, okay, this is a fun philosophical idea of what comes after death, but we don't know. In this movie,
I kind of felt that throughout. Like, I think creative writing, like, I think I wrote a story actually weirdly similar to this, which wasn't good then. but it was, inspirations, we can say, maybe it's flat out ripping off at certain points. There's a lot of flatliners in this movie, and then it kind of gets cut with Eternal Sunshine and Spotless Mind
a little.
And that was the stuff I could have used less of, to be honest. I actually sort of like the sci-fi premise. I like sort of this apocalyptic feel, which I think probably for budgetary reasons they couldn't go into as much as I would have liked them to. I think when it starts to become the indie romance with the quirky girl and like, that's when I kind of detach. When they push that narrative more, I found it less interesting.
Well, that's what I mean. And that's sort of what the whole third act is about, is
it becomes a story about like saving love or doing something in the name of love. And I think that that was so the least interesting way to go.
I agree. And that was, like I said, exactly sort of where I picked the movie back up. Mm-hmm. But like all the stuff with Robert Redford as like this horrible cult leader. And he's so
interesting in this movie. Like, he's like by far the most interesting character.
In Jason Segel's character, I think they could have done a little more with like how much is he going to put up with and like let him get away with. He sort of acts the whole time like, oh, gosh, Dad, stop it with your cult.
He's kind of a sad sack. He's not a very easy character to follow. He's kind of whiny.
Yeah, and I think it'd be more interesting like the idea that you come home and your dad starts a cult and like, how am I going to deal with this? Like, how am I going to react? Like, how far am I going to let things progress? Because that's sort of how cults do what they do, is, you know, by doing little allowances, little things here and there. And I think the idea of like, I think there were some cool ideas here. I think it just, it didn't quite
gel.
Yeah. And I think I agree. I think the whole love interest thing is where it, not that I didn't like Rooney Mara's performance or even her character.
She's fine. Yeah.
It's just like this throwing in this like romantic subplot was completely unnecessary and derailed.
By the end of the movie, it's not even a subplot. It becomes the point of the movie. And I was really? Like, you have all this other stuff you could go into, and then that's what you want to do with it?
Exactly. There's literally a moment where you can feel the movie shift. Mm-hmm. And that's when that's pretty much when I started rewatching, and I was like, oh, bummer. Because I was pretty into it up to that point. It is a bit of a slow start. Mm-hmm. But once they get to the compound, everything that sort of happens there, I was pretty on board with. I thought the opening scene was pretty cool. The news interview.
Yeah. Yeah.
I thought that was pretty cool. Like, that's a good intro. I think it's just this movie isn't better than the sum of its parts.
No, that's 100% the problem. Yeah. There's like individually, you know, Rooney Mara is good. Jesse Plemons is great at playing that character he always plays. Robert Redford is surprisingly still just interesting to watch.
Yeah, he is definitely the takeaway from this.
Yeah, you get your money's worth when you put Robert Redford in your movie. Conceptually there's interesting stuff, but I almost want like somebody to like take the germ of this idea and then like write like a spin-off movie about the more interesting stuff.
Yeah. It is unfortunate. At first I was like, okay, yeah, finally, here we go, Netflix. And then it was like, oh, they need to take like one more pass at the script or something. It just falls apart at the end to me.
Yeah. Yeah. And unfortunately, I think that Jason Segel is not really helping the overall quality of the movie. And it's nothing against him as an actor. I think he even could be good in a movie like this. I think it could be the way he was directed. I'm not sure. But he's kind of a Charlie Brown wishy-washy character.
Yeah, I don't think the problem is necessarily him. I think it's sort of more how the character's written.
Mm-hmm.
Let the sci-fi stuff just be the world that exists around us.
Mm-hmm.
Don't feel like you have to answer these questions or pay off these big paychecks, because you won't.
Mm-hmm. And without getting into the weeds or whatever, because I feel like we're already sort of, we're at a wrapping up point, but like there's this moment in the movie where all of a sudden it becomes about finding clues and like, oh, there's this thing, and like, oh, if we look at this, we got to go interview this person, and like this Hardy Boys stuff going on. It's like way too late into the movie to start a plot like that, and I just slowly started losing interest.
Yeah, I agree. Like the hint of that, like that scene where they first introduced that, I was like, okay, something kind of cool is going on here. But yeah, the more they dig into it, the more I'm like, I don't like this. I don't like where this is going. Like,
right.
And the more sort of plot holes start to emerge, the more gaps. And also, there was this thing that, this might be spoilery, I don't know. Again, we should make shirts, and one of them should say, this might be spoilery,
I don't know. This might be a spoiler.
right. Yeah. tweet us or email us if you would be interested in a shirt that says this might be a spoiler. So there's this part at the beginning where Jason Segel is talking about how he almost died as a kid. Mm-hmm. And then what we sort of learn from the world, I thought that was going to come back to be sort of a payoff. Because they kept focusing on it in such an intentional, idiosyncratic way that I was like, oh, okay, like he clearly died when he was a child, right? But that never comes back. And I'm like, oh, what? I don't know. And there was a lot of stuff like that in this movie that's like, they make something feel important, and then it never comes back in any meaningful or interesting way.
Yeah, that's the stuff that I would say feels like college creative writing, kind of short story writing. It's like there's a lot of these ideas that's like, oh, this is a cool little like winky wink. And then they either doesn't go anywhere or it's dealt with kind of clumsily.
Yeah, exactly.
So, yeah, unfortunately, I can't fully endorse this. I'd say it's like a C movie.
I'd say like C plus B minus. Like I think this is one of the better Netflix originals, just because it does have a tone that I sort of am on board with. Like I think you could do worse from like a late night binge. I think it's got enough going on to where it's, you know, it's worth watching if you're into the sort of tone of a Donnie Darko meets Eternal Sunshine.
Or whatever. Yeah, I wish I could be more on board with it, but I think ultimately as a story, it's just not satisfying. So, I'm feeling a C minus on this. But that's that. You wanted to surprise me. What are you surprising me with for the next time we do a Netflix homework?
All right. We're going to do it. We're going to complete the quintilogy of Pirates of the Caribbean, Dead Men Tell No Tales.
Oh, was that the one from like last year or the year before?
Uh-huh. The one that we never watched.
All right.
From last summer.
That is, if I was ever going to see it, that is the only way I was going to see it.
Yeah, I'm curious. I heard it was better than the last one, which really sucked, the one with the mermaids.
Right, right.
I heard this one is more on par with two and like number two and three. So I wanted to give it a shot. And, you know, I just went to Disneyland, just enjoyed some Pirates of the Caribbean myself. Mm-hmm. And so I want to check it out.
All right, cool. So that's the episode. And if anybody has any opinions about any of the opinions we shared on this, you can email us at jabberinthedrone@gmail.com and leave us a message there. You can also message us or find us on Twitter at jabberpodcast or on Facebook, facebook.com/jabberpodcast. You can find me individually at BC Cassidy. You can find my reviews that I do weekly for the Idaho State Journal at saladforkreviews.blogspot.com, as well as some of the content I provided for the Seattle-based entertainment site, The MacGuffin, at macguff.in/author/Cassidy. Where do they find you?
They can find me on Twitter at Keith Foster Kid, on Instagram at Keith Foster Kid. Twitter is for more angry, satirical, political bullshit. Instagram is for more cute, dumb stuff. And you can find me on Facebook too, Keith Foster. Check out Tonight in San Diego if you want. I think that's it for now.
Okay. And you have a website too, right?
Oh, yeah. www.keithfosterkid.com.
And we are also available to stream and download at all of your podcatchers, including Stitcher, iTunes, Player.fm, Pocket Cast, the Windows Podcast Network, and Google Play. Listen to our friends who also do podcasts. Rod and Denise at the Listening Party, Denise over at Mascot Diaries, Patrick and Dennis at Almost Educational, and Patrick and his father at Make Dad Read Comics, and Mike Falick over at Let's Start a Cult, and Bill and Brian over at the Great Albums Podcast, as well as...
I want to give some shout-outs to Adam Connie at the Adamant Podcast, the We Speak English Good Podcast. I just did a little guest episode there. We had a fun chat. And I just came out, well, this comes out on Thursday usually, so this would just come out on Monday. I just did a fun podcast called The Art of Bombing with Dan Bublitz. I don't know. He can let me know how to pronounce it, with Dan Bublitz. And, it's a fun podcast where he asks comedians or any kind of like live performance artists to tell their worst bombing story.
Okay.
Like the worst time they've done in front of a crowd. That was a really fun one. So we had a really good chat. So check those out. And cool. That's the Art of Bombing podcast.
Did you tell the story of when you and the Comedy Project were hired to do comedy for the Swinger convention?
No, I didn't actually tell that story.
Because that's one of my favorite stories of all time.
Well, that one we didn't really bomb, though.
No, but you all left feeling really bad about everything that just happened.
Well, we felt really icky and dirty, but it like they loved the show. So I didn't think of that because we didn't bomb.
Sure.
But yeah.
Save that story for a podcast one of these days, though.
Yeah.
Okay. And that's the show. So we will see you next week. Actually, it will be our Oscar episode with your wife again. We'll score our predictions and see how we did. So
check that out. All right. I have a little bit of a longer sign off for this week.
Uh-huh.
You ready? 'Cause baby, I compare you to a kiss from a rose on the gray.
Bye.